welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Oncology. This podcast aims to bring you expert perspectives from a multidisciplinary team on the current and emerging second-line treatment options for patients with extensive-stage small cell lung cancer. Specialists in the MDT involved in caring for patients with small cell lung cancer discuss individual patient cases to highlight current and emerging approaches to treatment, how treatment options are tailored to each individual patient, and how patient outcomes can be optimized through improved adverse event management in the second-line treatment setting. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from Jazz Pharmaceuticals and is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME. In this podcast, a medical oncologist and a pulmonologist discuss how side effects of small cell lung cancer treatment and patient performance status impact treatment selection and prognosis, and the potential for molecular classification to determine future treatment options.
Hello, my name is Barbara Molosky. I'm a medical oncologist and I treat only thoracic malignancies, and So I'm not going to say how long I've been a medical oncologist for, except to say that I've seen and treated many patients with small cell. Now, immunotherapy has really made finally a break into our treatment, because the chemotherapy that I used when I first graduated as a medical oncologist is the same I'm using now. So immunotherapy has really made its way. But today's conversation, and I'm going to introduce Dr. Christine Argento, is really tailoring treatment choices to the patient. And in the area of relapsed small cell after immunotherapy has failed. So I wanted to introduce my colleague, Dr. Christine Argento, who's a pulmonologist at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. So welcome, Christine. And
thank
Christine,
you.
I think you're going to present a case to us.
Yes, I am. So I had a patient recently that I think is a great example of this. So he's a 65-year-old gentleman. He smoked intermittently, as most people do, most of our patients do, for about 40 years. And he's got a history of extensive stage small cell lung cancer with brain metastasis. So he's received to date two cycles of atezolizumab, etoposide, and carboplatin. And he presented to the emergency department with chills for about 2 weeks, and then cough and weakness for about a week. When he was seen during his vital signs, he was found to be febrile to 103 degrees, and he had new hypoxia, so a new oxygen requirement. He had been on room air before that and now was requiring 4 liters by nasal cannula. So their initial screening testing, he did a respiratory viral panel, blood cultures that were all negative, and we did a CT angiogram partly to look for pulmonary embolism, which he didn't have. But what we do see is he's got his cancer, but we also see a lot of ground glass opacities that are sort of throughout the lung fields, particularly in the upper lobes, but also extending down into the lower lobes as well. And so this was sort of his initial presentation to us.
And was he, did you biopsy them? Did you do a scope? Did he get a bronchoscopy?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I don't know what you do in your institution. For us, I think if you're concerned that it's pneumonitis and you're pretty sure that's the reason for all of these changes on CT scan, then a biopsy probably isn't necessary. However, if you're not sure if there's lymphangitic spread, if there's infection there, and the patient is stable enough, then they can go for bronchoscopy. In this case, this patient actually ended up rapidly sort of decompensating from a respiratory standpoint. So he went from 4 liters of nasal cannula up to a high flow nasal cannula, up to 50 liters per minute of oxygen.
Sure.
And so he ended up being admitted into the ICU. And so he would be considered, you know, this sort of rapidly accelerating, heading towards respiratory failure patient. And so we deemed him to be unsafe as far as a bronchoscopy was concerned. And so what we ended up doing which I think follows the guidelines pretty much as far as pneumonitis is concerned, is we ended up giving him additional oxygen, starting him on broad spectrum antibiotics. So he got some cefepime, vancomycin. He ended up getting some fluids because he was then a little bit hypotensive. and we decided that he had pneumonia plus or minus a checkpoint inhibitor pneumonitis. And so for that, given that he would technically be considered a grade four, so, you know, grade one pneumonitis would be your asymptomatic patient who might have some changes on their imaging. Grade two would be your patient who has imaging findings and is symptomatic, but you can manage them as an outpatient. Grade three would be sort of the patient that needs admission to the hospital, and grade four would be your life-threatening patient, such as in this case, where they're admitted to the ICU. And so for him, what we did was, again, the antibiotics, and then started him on 2 mg/kg of methylprednisolone IV. And so we plan to do for him a 6 to 8 week course of steroids, decreasing slowly and tapering over time. And then obviously starting PJP prophylaxis and those kinds of things.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of the case that I had that, you know, he had quite a severe pneumonitis, ended up in the ICU, intubated, and was actually in there for about 2 months. And wow. The ICU guys kept calling me because they thought it was over, but he actually survived it. I kept telling them that, you know, this checkpoint pneumonitis is something that we aggressively treat and can get better. And I'm happy to say that was about a year ago, and he, you know, I just saw him recently, and he's back at work. So I think it's really, you know, if you manage these aggressively, you can actually have a good outcome. Now, in terms of the pneumonitis, I think that's kind of not funny, but I think we sort of throw everything at them. We give them steroids and antibiotics in case we missed, a febrile or a bacterial infection. But again, you know, radiation pneumonitis, a lot of the radiation oncologists, they taper it quite quickly. But I think with immune checkpoint pneumonitis, you really need that slow taper or you'll get in trouble.
Yeah, I feel like every patient that I've treated with an immune checkpoint related pneumonitis ends up relapsing if you taper too quickly.
Exactly. I think that's a great lesson. You know, I think that's a really great lesson. In fact, you know, I remember being doing a trial with the atezolizumab, and according to the protocol, it was a 3 month course of steroids. Like it wasn't, you know, 4 weeks or 8 weeks. It's actually 12.
It's so hard on the patient.
Yeah, I know.
They don't like it at all. But I think it's so important. Every time you back off too quickly because you're impatient or the patient is impatient, it backfires and you end up going up higher on steroids.
Christine, in terms of the patient that you presented that had pneumonitis requiring, you know, high dose steroids in a tapering course, would you, once he's settled down, start the immune checkpoint inhibitor again or not, or no?
For me, I would not re-challenge this patient again, just because of the severity of his pneumonitis. So I think if you have a patient with grade one, grade two, then a re-challenge is likely to happen. Mm-hmm. But once you get to grade three or four pneumonitis, I think that's when things get a little dodgy and you really have to think about whether it's safe to do so, because pneumonitis can definitely recur. It recurs in about half of patients. So you really want to be careful, especially those who had really severe symptoms.
Oh, I completely agree. And I think it's also because we have other options for second line. And again, we have CAV, topotecan, lurbinectedin. If you look at the NCCN guidelines, they have a whole other, you know, large amount of therapies, but those are sort of the big three. And, you know, I think you would stop the immunotherapy or the checkpoint inhibitor, get your patient back to, you know, a good quality of life where you can watch him. And when he progresses, he'd be a candidate for second line therapy.
Exactly. Yeah, that's been our approach as well.
Now, you know, when we diagnose small cell, you know, you get these cytology specimens. It's often done on cytology, tiny specimens. And then, you know, poof, urgent referral to medical oncology. But there's a lot of work being done into the biomarkers of small cell. It's really been fascinating, you know, starting with RNA expression by Dr. Rudin, followed by, you know, further stereotype or further classifying it by Dr. Gay. And so do you think that we're going to be asking pulmonologists and respirologists to get us bigger samples so we can figure out what the biomarkers are?
I do. I think biomarkers are definitely the way of the future. We see that in non-small cell as well as in small cell carcinomas now. And so most of the time, I would say, you know, biopsying for lung cancer for many patients is really being done by endobronchial ultrasound or EBUS. And those are small FNA samples, just like you mentioned. So they're technically not your core biopsies that we were used to when they were done by radiology, for example. But we have found that, especially with, you know, newer technologies, that you're requiring less and less cells, even though we're ordering more and more testing. And our samples have been more than sufficient to be able to detect a lot of these genetic mutations and biomarkers that exist, and they really do guide treatment. So I think it's really important to have that discussion, you know, between the medical oncologist and the respirologist or pulmonologist, just to make sure that those tests all get done up front. They do take time. So even though they're all done, it can delay treatment pretty significantly if you don't order them sort of off the bat. So I think that having that discussion, whether you're going to actually utilize that test or not, is important.
That's excellent. And I'm going to remind the viewers or who's watching is that, you know, there's some really exciting work into, you know, the subtypes of small cell lung carcinoma. And you know, if you get a chance to read the paper by Dr. Gay, it's fascinating where, you know, he took looking at RNA expression and was able to classify small cell into four different types. And not only the four different types, but perhaps therapeutic drugs that could be used in those four different types. And of course, what we all sort of were looking at that, you know, finally a biomarker was being seen as small cell. But I'm going to remind people that this isn't EGFR. It's not plus or minus a mutation. You know, this is expression and it's a bit gray. And certainly from the presentation by Stephen Liu at ASCO 2021, it looks like these subtypes actually might be at this time prognostic of a response, not so much predictive of a response. And you know, you sort of look at these subtypes, you know, A, N, P, I, you would never deny a patient treatment depending on that subtype. So I think it's a really important lesson and it's exciting because it's going to lead to further work into classification of small cell and hopefully direct treatment. But at the present time, you know, I'm going to remind people that this is far from use today in the clinic. So do you have any last sort of things to say, Christine, about, you know, your role as a pulmonologist looking at patients with extensive stage small cell?
I mean, I think this is just a really exciting time. Everything's changing so quickly. For me, it's all about communication with the patient, making sure that they know what to think about, what they know what to look for, communication with your colleagues, medical oncology, radiation oncology, et cetera. I think all of the points that we just talked about, it's a really exciting time.
It really is. It's always surprises me, you know, every day I'm ordering a PD-L1 test and, you know, small cell lung carcinoma, there are these heavy smokers and yet PD-L1 and TMB don't seem to help us. And it might be that we're not getting a big enough sample. You know, we might be coming back to you and asking you to get more.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be the role now of having a cytopathologist in the room or a tech in the room to make sure that our sample is cellular enough, is giving us adequate, you know, tissue to do all of the testing that's required. Yeah.
Well, that's a great case. I just wanted to thank you for sharing it with us and your expertise. And, you know, again, pneumonitis is something that as a medical oncologist, I dread, but I have a lot of hand-holding with people like you, which is really great. So thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic at www.touchoncology.com. Don't forget there are two other chapters in this series, so please listen in for further insights from the multidisciplinary team.